Well, good morning. It is good to be here, and it was good to catch the little bit of the Sunday school that I caught. I think we need a little better system, but I like the idea of sharing audio over the live stream of the men's Sunday school, if we're all good with that. Maybe we'll figure out a way to do a camera back there, too. But I know it really helps with translating and so thanks, Vadim, for getting that set up. For any visitors that are here, we have been working on a series looking at the kind of the big events in the Old Testament that led up to the coming of Jesus. And we're on part 28. And last time we looked at the very beginning, well, I guess it was the end. I guess it was the beginning of Joshua. The story of Rahab, and we looked at how Rahab ended up in the Hall of Fame of Faith, along with Abraham and Moses and Gideon and David, and we saw how Rahab made the choice to reject the kingdom she had grown up in, and by her actions she placed her faith in the God of the Israelites, and I'm happy to say that we're actually finally ready to cross the Jordan. I think we're going to do this. We're going to dive right in. And it may have taken us a while to get here, but it took the Israelites 40 years, so I guess we're still doing better than them. There's so many fascinating parts of this account, and I think we could probably spend a couple sermons on this, but I think we're going to try to wrap it up in one. Just for the sake of continuing on with the many, many other stories that we'll have to look at and people. But I kind of have three goals for this morning. The first one is to just understand what happened and how it happened, looking at the actual text and the story. The number two is understanding why it's so significant. Why is this such an important story in the grand scheme? And then number three is learn why this story should affect our decisions and actions. How does it actually apply to us? So I'm just going to start by reading Joshua chapter 3. If you want to turn there, you can follow along. There is more to the story. There's the part where they set up the memorial afterward. But I think we're not going to read that this morning. But if you want to continue on and understand that all, there's a whole other probably significant part to that. But we're just going to read chapter 3. So Joshua chapter 3 says, "Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, 'As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it in order that you may know that the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before.'" Sorry, I think I read that wrong. "Do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you.' And Joshua said to the priests, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people.' So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the Lord, before the people. The Lord said to Joshua, 'Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan.' And Joshua said to the people of Israel, 'Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God.' And Joshua said, 'Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, and the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters out of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand up in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the Ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the Ark were dipped in the brink of the water, in parentheses, now the Jordan overflows all its bank throughout the time of harvest, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, or Adam, maybe. Depends who you're listening to. The city that is beside Zarethan, and those flowing down toward the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Okay, lots to dig into here. The first thing that I realized after reading this is that I have never really looked at the Ark of the Covenant. And that was a very significant thing to the Israelites. I think we touched on it briefly maybe two or three Sundays ago, just mentioned it, sermons ago, but I never really looked at the significance of what that was or how it was made, any of that. And I'm not going to dig into it deeply here this morning for sake of time, but I'll just kind of mention it. This was commanded to be made back at Mount Sinai. And it's referred to as the Ark was basically a box, 52 inches long, 31 inches wide, and then 31 high, so roughly 4 by 3 by 3. It was made out of acacia wood and then completely covered in gold. And then on top of that was what was called the mercy seat. Actually, could you throw up the picture there? I have it on presenter. I forgot to mention it. This is kind of a representation of what, based on the explanation that we see there in the text, of what this maybe would have looked like. So completely covered in gold, and then on top of it we have the mercy seat, which has the cherubim kind of representing what was supposed to be like God hovering over his people, his protection over them. And then also very significant were those poles, the rings on the side. That's very detailed, or explained in detail when they were given the instructions on how to make it. They were not allowed to touch the box. And we remember, probably remember when they were moving the Ark from, I think it was from after one of their battles, they moved it from the battlefield back into Jerusalem, I believe it was. It was on a cart, and a man touched it and was immediately killed. So they were not allowed to touch the actual Ark of the Covenant there, so they had those poles there, and the priests were supposed to carry it. The reason this was so significant is that way back at the beginning of this whole story, God promised to Abraham that he would live among his people. And I know we've touched on this before, but the significance of that is something that we probably don't grasp. God's presence always brought blessing and protection. And this ark was supposed to be the place that God kind of dwelled, at least a portion of his presence. Obviously, God cannot be contained in a box, but it represented the place where God dwelled among his people. And so that's why that was such a significant thing. And so anytime you see the ark being mentioned, think of it in terms of this is a visual representation of the presence of God among his people. It's more than just a box and where the Ten Commandments were kept. This was where the presence of God lived. And obviously this was normally kept inside the ark or the tabernacle when they were still traveling around. Later it was in the temple. And nobody could actually see this except for the priests. As soon as they packed up to move, they had, I think it's in Numbers 4. Yeah, it's Numbers 4, 5, and 6. It says, when the camp is set out, this is instructions, when the camp is set out, Aaron and his sons shall go in and take down the veil of the screen and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it, or what we call the Ark of the Covenant. Then they shall put on it a covering of goatskin and spread on top of that a cloth of blue, and shall put it on its poles. So when this was actually being transported by the priests, no one could actually see it. It was completely covered during that time. And it doesn't really say if that's how it was when they, as we're reading this story, if it was actually covered or if that was kind of a unique thing and they were able to see it. I would kind of maybe think that it was able to be seen because of the fact that they had to keep a distance from it. And we'll look at that next here. So we very clearly see there in Joshua 3 that the Israelites could not even get close to it. They were told that they had to stay 2,000 cubits, which would be a little over a half mile. And just to visually think of that, if you were to go up the street here and go all the way up to the school, you know, there where the park is, that's about the distance that we're talking. So could have been seen, and they were supposed to watch its movement, but that's as close as they were supposed to get to it. Verse 5, Joshua tells the people to consecrate themselves and to get ready for God doing something that was going to be amazing. And we're not really told what that consecration was, but based on what we see other times when the children of Israel were asked to consecrate themselves, probably involved washing themselves and maybe offering sacrifices. But there's a couple things that God wanted to do with this, and one of them was he wanted to make it very clear to the Israelites that he was with Joshua, just like he was with Moses. And I think there's some very practical reasons for that. The people needed a leader, and if they didn't respect their leader, it was going to be very hard for him to be effective as a leader. We remember a while ago when we looked at the character of Joshua, we saw that Joshua pointed forward to Jesus. There was a number of things in his life that kind of correlated with who Jesus was. Even the translation of Joshua from Hebrew into Greek is Jesus. But there's some other things that I never caught until here. One of those things is that God used the Jordan River to kind of exalt Joshua in the eyes of the people through this miracle. And God also exalted Jesus in the Jordan River at his baptism. I'd never thought of that before, how that those two correlate. That's just another interesting thing there. In the case of Joshua, it was by stopping the Jordan River, and with Jesus, I'm sure there's more representation here we could look at, but with Jesus, the river continued to flow. And in a sense, he was showing that baptism, I think, would be the washing away of our sins. Maybe that was one of the things. With Joshua, they were still in the Old Covenant. It was a stopping of the flow. Maybe that represented to some degree the sacrifices being a temporary stopping of the punishment for sin. With Jesus, it was the ushering in of a baptism that would take away those sins and remove them completely. Anyway, I don't know if that's... I would have to dig into that more to see if that's all theologic, so don't take that to the bank, I guess. But just a couple things I was thinking of there in that symbolism. Anyway, Joshua was supposed to tell the people exactly what was going on. This is what was so interesting to me. Other times when God did miracles, he didn't necessarily spell it all out exactly how it was going to happen. He just worked through somebody and the thing happened. But in this case, God gives very specific instructions on exactly how he wants the priests to do this, and even explains exactly how he wants Joshua to present it to the people. And I wonder if part of the reason for that was what we looked at just a little bit ago of wanting to exalt Joshua in the eyes of the people and making it clear that God was with him. Not exalting him in the sense of, you know, being someone that they worshipped, but someone that they respected and knew that God was with him. If Joshua had just said, you know, God's going to do something amazing, I don't know what, but just kind of take it easy and see what happens, it wouldn't have necessarily indicated that God had specifically spoken to him. I mean, maybe somewhat, But in this case, it was completely spelled out. Joshua explains that to the people, like in detail, specific details. And then that exact thing happens. And so the people would have had to have recognized that God had spoken directly to Joshua, just like he did to Moses before. I had to think, too, like for Joshua, even though he did hear from God and spoke directly, God spoke directly to him, I have to wonder if there was any doubts. Like, what if I got a detail wrong? Like, what if I misunderstood him? But he tells the people exactly what he heard, down to the specific details. So that took faith on his part to just relay that exactly as he understood God told it to him. And we know the story. It happened exactly as Joshua said. When the soles of the feet of the priests touch the water stands up in a heap. And I've always imagined that was something that happened, like, you know, just right up from where the Israelites crossed. I don't know if it was Bible story pictures that I would have seen of this account or drawings or whatever. But that's actually completely not the case. This did not pile up right in front of where they crossed. This actually, it says that it happened at the city of Adam, and that's actually about 18 miles upstream or upriver from where they actually crossed. Of course, that brings some questions like, well, how could they have even known it, or how could they have seen it? Well, I think something this huge, like, people would have went running to figure out what's going on. Like, a river at flood stage doesn't just stop. There had to have been eye testimony of this, either directly from the Israelites or people that lived in the city or something. So I don't think that's that hard to imagine, that someone would have went and looked at what's actually going on here. Or at least after the fact, it would have been clear. So this is 18 miles upstream. And the one thing that does is allows, at first when I was reading this, I was like, well, how are they supposed to stay 2,000 cubits or half a mile from the ark if the ark was parked in the middle of the river? But that could explain it. Now, there's some theories that say, well, they didn't necessarily follow that once the ark was in the middle of the river. Then they were able to walk around it and they didn't have to stay that distance away. But I don't think that really lines up. Why would God choose to change that just because they were in the middle of the river? I don't know. I wasn't there. But understanding that there was 18 miles of space, and also understanding that this was a huge group, and we're talking over 1 million people and plus all their livestock, that would have taken a while if they had to go, like, you know, single file on either side of the ark and they only had 50 feet to work with. In this case, they had miles to work with and they could spread out as far as they needed to, and it does say that they went over quickly, and that would have definitely helped with the speed of it if they had that distance to walk over. And I just like to imagine sometimes these things feel like a long ways away and it's nothing that we could ever put ourselves in the middle of, but just think a little bit about that amount of water. Now, I don't know exactly how much water this was. Right now, if you go to this place when it's not flood stage, the Jordan River is not really that big of a river. But I think a lot of things could have changed. For one thing, there was probably a lot of water directed or has been redirected off of the Jordan since then to just take care of crops and stuff. So this may have been a bigger river then than it is now when you consider the redirection. And then also it does specifically say that it's flood stage, so it was probably fairly fast flowing and wide. So think about how much... There's some theories, actually, that the place where this happened, as far as piling up, was at a place where there could have been like a mudslide or a rock slide off of a mountain that just blocked the river right at that point and then redirected it, and that's how we get this. But I don't think that really accounts for the fact that they were able to walk across right away. If you just block the flow of a river 18 miles upstream, it's going to take a good amount of time for that to actually start slowing down and get to the place where it's no longer flowing. Furthermore, after that, you're going to be left with a big muddy mess, I would think. I guess I don't know what, what the ground around there was like, but most likely if you're talking about a flood stage, you're going to have a whole lot of silt and mud to deal with. It's not something you could take a million people across immediately. But it says that it was dry ground and they were all able to walk across right away. So I think that indicates that this was a miracle. It was just, there was no physical way to explain this aside from God just sucking the water away, putting it up on a pile, and making the ground dry. And I just imagine what that would have looked like to see a wall of water. Like if that's how you think about it, you're talking 18 miles of river that had to stand up at the point where it was stopped. And that would have been a huge mountain of water. And I also wonder, it says that it was close to these two cities, and it doesn't say this, but think about what would have happened to that water that continued to flow. You just put a dam like that over a flooding river, what's going to happen with the water behind it? It's going to start flooding behind it. I have to wonder if that was like God already conquering those cities by just flooding them out and possibly, you know, killing the people in it. Doesn't say that that happened. In some ways, I think if that would have happened, it would have been significant enough that it would have been in the text. But either way, it's a big deal and an amazing thing that God did here. I think we tend to associate, or I've always tended to associate this with like a smaller version of what God did at the Red Sea, but really, in some ways, it's even more amazing to think of that. I had to think too, like just bringing it down to our level, I guess, and what this actually, why is this significant? Like, why does this actually matter in the big scheme of everything? Like, God had done a bunch of other amazing things with the Israelites, but why is this story so significant, and why is it still probably one of the highlights of the whole thing? Well, I think the first point is that we already looked a little bit at this fact, but God wanted to exalt Joshua in front of the people. However, that wasn't the main point of the miracle. I think that was a secondary one. You know, God didn't have Joshua go, like, strike the river. If that was his only goal, he could have, like, made Joshua more prominent in the actual miracle. Joshua was only there to tell what God was going to do and show that God had showed him. But when it came to the actual miracle, it was still completely on God. In fact, after Joshua says what he's supposed to say to the people, he's kind of out of the picture, never even mentions him again in the story. It's all then about the Ark of the Covenant and what the priests do, which represents the presence of God. And by having the Ark of the Covenant go first, it's very clear that God is the one doing the miracle. Now, God is still the one leading the people and doing the amazing things. God only uses Joshua to communicate that to the people. And I think that's partly because the people can't even get close to God. And it's very clear that God is getting the glory through this. You know, these people, this generation of Israelites, would have heard about the Red Sea and the miracle that God did there, but they wouldn't have seen it themselves because that generation had died off in the 40 years before this, walking around in the wilderness. So I think God is just reestablishing the fact that he is with his people and that he is going to do miracles through them, and he is going to help them conquer the land. And that's my next point here, is that God did this to show that the Israelites will conquer the land. I didn't understand the significance of this in terms of that either. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan, that was an act of war. Before the Israelites, you know, when they were staying on the other side of the Jordan, the Canaanites probably were living in some fear. They're like, what are these people going to do? But as long as they stayed on that side of the border, I think they wouldn't have messed with them. They wouldn't have felt like they needed to go fight with them or anything. Because they had already, you know, conquered a couple kings over there that were causing trouble in that land. But as soon as they stepped across that line, it was clear they were here to conquer things. They were on the move. I had to think of it like if the same thing happened with us and the border with Mexico. We've got the Rio Grande down there at the border. If Mexico suddenly put like 40,000 armed soldiers right on the line there, like we'd probably be getting a little nervous. Like, what is going on here? And you'd have some people talking back and forth for sure. But I can't imagine that the U.S. government would do anything. They wouldn't like necessarily preemptively, you know, strike or do anything as long as they stayed on that side. But the second those soldiers cross that river, it's immediate war. I mean, you know what's coming. And I think that's part of why this is such a big deal for the Israelites. They knew that crossing that meant they were then at war, and it was no longer just them living in a camp. This meant struggle for the next however many years it took to conquer the whole land. And that's why I think God wanted to use such a miraculous thing to lead up to that, to show them that this wasn't on them. Like, God was going to go before them, he was going to conquer, he was with them, and this was his plan, this was his goal for them. Obviously, the area of Canaan was different than what we think of now in terms of governments. There wasn't necessarily a central government that controlled the whole area. It was set up more in what they call city-states. Kings were kind of in charge of a city, and then maybe the land surrounding it that supported that city. So there wouldn't have necessarily been like a central government that had an army that could come defend the whole land. But you can't move into an area without conquering those cities, and they knew that. And I think the third point I have in relation to why this is so significant is it's kind of a summary, and it was just another reminder that God keeps his promises. He will keep his promises. This was a promise made all the way back to Abraham that they would take this land, and that he would live with them in that land. And secondly, that obeying God always results in blessing. And then also that God rewards radical faith in him. And that kind of brings it down to how this affects us. And I was struggling for a while to how does this actually relate to us in our life? Because we're not out, you know, necessarily conquering lands. God hasn't, at least that was my initial thought. But then I thought about it deeper, and I realized that, in a sense, we are. We can get pretty comfortable here, but we are called to conquer the land, to push back darkness, and to bring people into the kingdom of God. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, but just a couple things that I wanted to draw out of this. First thing that hit me was that thought of the holiness of God. The people had to stay over a half mile away from the ark, and that only represented a tiny part of the presence of God, of who God was. I'm afraid that for me, like far too often, I think about God, or when I think about God, or when I study the Bible or pray, I think that God kind of owes me something because I did this for him, or I did this. I took the time to go to a prayer meeting, so God should answer my prayers. And maybe I wouldn't necessarily say that, but it's a subconscious thing. Like, well, I did the work, and now God, it's your turn to return the favor here. And the fact of the matter is God does not owe me anything. When I see the holiness of God, and it just really hit me again in studying this, like the fact that without the work of what Jesus did on the cross, I couldn't even get close to him. I couldn't even pray to him. Why do I think that God owes me something? The fact that God chooses to bless or to even listen to me is only a reflection of his character and nothing to do with me or how amazing I think I might be. And by extension, I think I'm more and more convinced that the more you understand God and who he is or understand of God, the closer you get to him, the more pathetic and broken you realize you are. And I don't think we can say that in like some kind of false humility. It's just the fact of the matter. Like, the closer you get to God, the more you realize how different you are from Him, how holy He is, and how, yeah, messed up and weak and helpless I am, especially when it comes to victory over sin. Without that Holy Spirit living in and around me, I have no power over that. But here's what's amazing in that, and I think really getting that point doesn't drive us away from God. When I read through Matthew, sometimes it's easier for me to actually put myself in the shoes of the Pharisees and sometimes the disciples that didn't get it. You know, I was just reading that account of what was her name? The lady that came and poured the perfume on Jesus' head, and right away the disciples were like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Don't do this. This is wasting all this perfume." And everyone got worked up over it. And like, you know, I'm into managing finances and whatever. That would probably be my initial thought too. I don't get it always. I put myself into the place of the people that think they have it put together, and yet Jesus was quicker to want to associate and spend time with the broken people around him, the lepers and the beggars and the prostitutes and the tax collectors. Those are the ones that he spent the most time with. I mean, with the exception of his disciples. But I think when I really get the fact that I'm just a needy sinner, and that holiness of God is so opposite from me, I can really, it's only then that I can really understand how much Jesus actually loves me. That he would have the grace and the love to come spend time with us and to provide a way that we could actually get close to God. We didn't have to stay that half mile away from just the presence of God. We can actually communicate with him now. So realizing our brokenness makes it easier to really trust, I think, and rely on God. When I think I pretty much have it put together and I start to see God as less important than maybe my own opinions and decisions, it's stories like this that make me realize again that, no, you don't. God is so much greater and holier than you. And really, I think the beauty of this story in Joshua is that the Israelites really had no other options for getting across the Jordan safely, at least not for quite a while. God had them in a position where their only option was either to run away and completely abandon God's plan to move into Canaan, or move ahead with what God told them to do, completely in faith, and to do what God told them to. You know, they didn't have the resources to build a bridge or a bunch of boats. At least, we don't think they did. God had to do something big for this to work. And sometimes I think we find ourselves in places that like that, but often it's after we've thought of every possible other way around it. We try to come up with alternatives. And often I think we just play it safe. We just don't even do the thing that maybe we think God is asking us to do. We don't very often make life-changing decisions that absolutely require faith in God and absolutely require God to actually work it out. Like, there's no way we can do it on ourselves. I don't know. Well, we don't have the presence of God speaking to us directly quite like he did here, and specifically telling us to do things that are just, you know, super clearly spelled out. But we do have the Bible, and we do have the Holy Spirit. And there's plenty of commands and things told us, especially in Scripture, that doesn't really require God to say it again for us to do it. And how many times do I read those things and I'm like, well, but, you know, we still have to live life, so, you know, you just kind of ignore that a little bit or figure out a way to explain around it. When just simply obeying it would take a pretty amazing act of faith. But when we don't do that, we completely miss out on the miracle that God may want to do in that situation or in obeying that thing. And I know I'm speaking in kind of generalities here, but I think that's different in each of us. As God reveals things to you, it's your choice. You can either step in faith or choose to ignore that. There are plenty of things that God told us to do in the Bible that are risky and would require faith and the work of God to get it right. It doesn't require us to know exactly what the entire plan should be, though, and I think that's where we get tripped up. We have to think that if we have something that God's asking us to do, we have to have it all figured out first. We have to know what the outcome's going to be. And so if we don't do that, we don't take that first step. In a sense, the Israelites knew, or at least were told, what was going to happen in terms of crossing the Jordan, but they didn't know what was going to happen after that. I was going to mention, too, this is actually one story where the Israelites completely get it right. And that's kind of unusual. I don't know if there's probably more to learn in that, but so many of the stories of the Israelites are of them getting it wrong, but this is actually one where they get it right. There's no indication that they complained or there were a certain group that didn't want to do it. Apparently they just did what God told them to do, and that's kind of a miracle in itself, I think. But back to kind of how we do things. I know that this concept of stepping out in faith and doing things that just look crazy, I know that that has been abused by some groups, especially when you get into like the faith healing stuff. But I think, and maybe just even some groups that just lack wisdom and understanding, or maybe are taking scriptures out of context sometimes. However, I don't think that's our tendency here. At least it isn't for me. I think our tendency is much more to play it safe and to just not ever take the risk, not take that first step that God is asking us to sometimes. Maybe it's the fear of what I think my neighbor will think of me if I bring up Jesus in a conversation. I mean, something as maybe small as that. Or, like, I thought it was really cool how, like, right now we have the opportunity, you guys, and I guess if God shows that I should do this too, I want to totally be open, but the opportunity to go to Laos right now, like, that looks scary. Nobody, I don't think any of you have done anything quite like that. And so that looks risky. Like, what if you do end up in jail? But what if you are completely missing out on a huge miracle that God wants to do, and like the journey of a lifetime, the trip of a lifetime, because of that fear, because maybe no one in your family has done it before? This theme comes up over and over. I know we've looked at the idea of faith before, especially in the story of Rahab, but faith is not just a strong belief in something. And I know I keep saying this, but faith is the action that belief makes you do. If the Israelites had stayed on the other side of the Jordan and just said, yes, we believe that God can part these waters, he can take us over there, and they would have like sung songs for a week, but never actually took that first step and stepped into the water, it wouldn't have made any difference, right? It's not the belief in your head, and it's not even the voicing of that belief. It's the action that goes with that belief that actually is the faith. The priests could have even led that, I guess, but it was, and I love how it specifically says that when the soles of their feet, not just like when they stepped in, but when the soles of their feet touched the water, it's just like gone. So I imagine that their feet never even got wet. Like that's how fast God was ready to work when they obeyed. But just in conclusion here, if you're feeling that nudge to do something that you've never done before and is just out of your comfort zone, I would say consider this story. I I think it's good to get counsel from our brothers. We're told to do that. But sometimes I think we go find like-minded people who are maybe less prone to risk and try to find the right people to agree with us that maybe this isn't the greatest idea, even though we feel that nudge that maybe we should. I'm not trying to, I don't have anyone in mind here. I'm not pointing at anyone. I'm pointing at myself. But I think even though it's good to get that counsel, there's also a place where you have to make a decision to act on what God is calling you to do and take that step. And sometimes that single act of obedience by you can lead to amazing things in the people around you too. In this case, it was the priests, and then the whole nation was blessed because of their obedience. First of all, Joshua, I guess, as the leader. But maybe you just need to take that step of faith and allow God to start piling up some waters. And I'll trust that God shows you what that is when it's the right time. So, thank you. Dad, do you want to close? Okay.